Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, this evening we'd hope to have with us Michael Chapman, coming from Minneapolis or Minnesota, from what used to be known as Mr. Edco, a group of political activists in the state of Minnesota who been able to have a profound impact on education in that state. One of their members, Michelle Bachman, has been elected to the state senate. And, you know, it's amazing what people can do if they really commit themselves to this battle. But, unfortunately, we can't seem to be able to get through to Michael Chapman. So I guess we're going to have open lines, and I have absolutely nothing prepared. So I'm going to leave the lines open. If you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And in lieu of anything specifically to talk about, I'm going to tell you a little bit about a talk I'm preparing to give next week. And it's going to be dealing with the coming financial tsunami. The very real financial problems that our country faces, and in fact, all the countries of the world face, because we've abandoned the traditional concepts that deal with the problems that face nations, and that is we have a fiat money system here in the United States. And certainly countries throughout the world traditionally had gold as the backing for their currency, and then they gradually phased out gold, and really since the August 15th, 1971, there's been no gold backing for any country in the world. And after that date, America started a great spiral of inflation, which peaked out in 1979, and with the interest rates having to rise to 21% to break the back of the inflation that threatened to destroy the currency system of the United States. Well, we did get things back on track, and had the leaders of the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States done what was correct and guarded the value of our currency, we would not be in a situation today where we're looking down a line just a few years with massive federal deficits and no possible way to pay them. And our leaders know that what's going on, and they've set us up for a truly financial tsunami earlier this week. Why we saw one of the most dramatic increases in the price of gold and silver I've seen in 26 years, going back to 1979. Well, fortunately, our guest has arrived, so you're going to have to wait until we actually have the video, and we have the new syllabus put together. That'll be available in about 2 weeks. But I just wanted to warn our listeners to begin making preparations financially, because we're in for a very bad time. But with that as the background, Michael Chapman, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Stan. It's always a pleasure to be a guest on your show.
Well, certainly you've been working up there in Minnesota, and you've been trying to get the information out about what is happening to our educational system. And when we get back from this break, we're going to get into the background of an organized plan to use education to transform our society. There are really people who hate America, and one of the vehicles to destroy it is through our educational system. Well, Michael, let you pick up the story there.
Well, I'll tell you, Stan, you said it just perfectly, and I like to hear you use that word, transform our society, because that is clearly the goal, and that is not my words. Those are actually the words coming out of the U.S. Department of Education, where, for example, in the National Council for the Social Studies, curriculum standards for social studies, a lot of people don't even know we have curriculum standards on a national level for social studies. the introduction to the lesson, or to the standards booklet, says that it is clear that the dominant social, economic, cultural, and scientific trends that have defined the Western world for five centuries is leading in new directions. Therefore, the primary purpose of social studies is to help people develop the ability to make decisions for the public good as citizens of a new society, what they call a culturally diverse, democratic society in an interdependent world. So that is clearly the content goal of education. It's one of the reasons we deal with the rewriting of our history. We deal with fuzzy math, because math knowledge is not as important as knowing which buttons to push on a calculator. We have a utilitarian concept of education now. By that I mean most people will answer, because they've been trained to answer, that the purpose of education is to prepare for future work. And that work now will be determined for us by planning boards that are being formed all over the country in all 50 states, down to the local level, to determine the future labor needs of America. And then they will retrofit our children in public schools to meet those labor needs. So they're being trained for their particular station in life. So basically what we're dealing with is a two-pronged problem with education. One, it's content, and number two, it's purpose and structure. That's, in a nutshell, what has gone wrong, the big picture.
And, of course, I think that the most difficult thing is for people to understand that what is happening is not happening by accident. There is a master plan. There are master planners. They know exactly what they're doing, and they've been working for 500 years. And I think that the figure you use is really so revealing. Because in October of 1992, David Rockefeller wrote an editorial for the Wall Street Journal. And I'll never forget reading that. And one of the things he said is, we've got to pass NAFTA because we've been waiting for 500 years. And how could you be possibly waiting 500 years? Well, we'll answer that in just a moment when we return with our other stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Michael Chapman, and he's talking about how material you will actually get from the Department of Education readily admits that there is a plan to transform our society. One of the things they talk about is the fact that they've been working for 500 years, or waiting for 500 years, to change the structure of our society. And I was simply commenting that in October of 1992, David Rockefeller wrote an editorial for the Wall Street Journal. It appeared on the editorial page, where he talked about how we had to get NAFTA through. Now, remember, this was 1992. We had to get NAFTA through because we have been waiting for 500 years. And, you know, as I read that, I thought, you know, David Rockefeller is pretty old, but he's not 500 years old. What's he talking about? What happened 500 years ago? Well, and then, of course, I remember that was 1492, when Columbus came to America and began to establish this forerunner of the civilization we have here. And there have been people who have really been waiting for 500 years to transform our society. Who are these people? What is their agenda? And pick up the story, Michael.
Well, really, obviously, there's nobody alive today that is 500 years old, and this is one of the problems we get into and get ourselves labeled as conspiracy theorists. Not that there aren't conspiracies, but I believe that this is a conspiracy of ideas. Really what we're facing is a battle of ideas, and there are people behind those ideas who naturally hold a different worldview from what the worldview that defined Western civilization. As I said in that quote, that it's clear we're moving in new directions, and so education now has to be about these new ideas. Well, these really aren't new ideas at all. As you say, they go back 500 years. Actually, you can take them all the way back to biblical times. You know, the building of the Tower of Babel, the first attempt to unite the entire world under one global banner, if you will. These are worldview ideologies that drive people to action. A lot of the people behind these plans just don't hold the same worldview that Christian Western world hold. And some of the basic ideas that formulate what you define as the purpose of education or how best to structure the economy are 180 degrees diametrically opposed to the Christian Western civilized ideas that our founding fathers espoused. Let me just give you one example. Is mankind by nature sinful, or is he by nature good? You see, the problem here is if you actually believe that man is good by nature, then how do you explain the evil man does? It must come from something outside of man, some externals that caused him to be bad. So the solution then on the left is to control the environment, control the externals to try to perfect man. This was Karl Marx's entire idea, and of course it was not new either when Karl Marx came up with it. These ideas grow up on their own when you reject the truth that man was placed here by a designer with a specific purpose, that he fell from that grace and has an inherent sin nature that must be checked. The entire reason our founders put together a three-branch system of government was out of a biblical concept that knew that mankind would, given his own devices, fall into temptation and self-preservation and sin nature. He'd take the path of least resistance. So our founders created checks and balances to check man's power. Well, the utopian idealists don't believe these things, and so they see the solution to fix the environment to perfect man. In other words, take away the guns, there won't be crime, is what they would say. Redistribute wealth equally, and then nobody will need to steal. Of course, these things have proven themselves false time and time again. Every civilization tries these ideas when the civilization finally breaks down and can't stand itself. It tries to restructure these same ideas. So it isn't so much that a group of people in a smoke-filled room have been planning the overthrow of America for 500 years, as much as it is a group of people in a smoke-filled room want to try what they consider new ideas that are really as ancient as time itself.
But don't you really feel there's a spiritual component to what's really going on today? In other words, what you're describing on one side, you know, is the traditional biblical view that man is basically sinful. And then there are the people who would reject that because they reject the biblical interpretation of history, and they think that they can actually replace these ideas of God with their own.
That's exactly right. And so keep in mind that these two worldviews, both worldviews, the Christian worldview and call it the secular humanist worldview, both of them are inherently religious.
They really are.
There's a belief in a God on the one side, and there's a belief that there is no God on the other. They can't prove there is no God any more than they claim we can't prove there is. And so these fundamental base ideas result in a completely different understanding of human nature and man and how he organizes himself in society. And unfortunately, as far as education and the economy and government is concerned, we have been completely taken over by people who hold the opposite worldview to that of the founders.
Well, but how are they able to take over our country? In other words, how are they able to get their people into key positions in government and within the political structure of our society?
Well, I think part of it is the motive. I mean, if you think about it, people who hold an individual liberty idea that inherently springs from the Christian worldview tend to keep to themselves and mind their own business, so to speak. When you're on the other side of the equation, your entire worldview is about your footprint that you leave in the world and your cause. And so anything becomes morally ethical if it's promoting your cause. And so I believe that those folks on the left who hold this worldview honestly, in many cases, believe they're doing what's best for mankind without realizing that they are putting in place the principles that will absolutely overthrow mankind. On the far end of that spectrum, on the radical end of it, there are people there who believe that mankind is the problem with the world. And if we can just eradicate certain numbers of men for the purpose of sustaining the environment, and sustaining planet Earth will create a utopia, a perfect world where we won't ever run out of resources. And they hold these faulty ideas based on a worldview motive. And so they purposely are putting these things in place and hiding it from people because they don't, they understand that it won't be readily accepted. So they hide behind wonderful sounding terms like school to work and sustainable development and outcome-based education and those kind of things.
Well, now, certainly if they know what they're doing and they're working in concert to conceal what they're doing, wouldn't that almost be sort of a conspiracy?
Well, absolutely. By definition, you know, any time several people are gathered in a room planning a strategy, they're conspiring. We're conspiring to stop them, if you will. So, yes, conspiracies happen all the time. I don't think we're going to bust the conspiracy unless we get to the root ideas that cause them to hold these conspiracies.
And I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, I believe there is a spiritual component to everything going on today, and I believe that there really are people, as you say, who would like to eliminate a large part of the population of the world. That is such a unique idea, you know, and really such a devastating idea. I know it took me at least a decade to actually come to accept there could be people who would have such a different worldview than you and I would. In other words, well, we believe in the value of human life. They don't believe in the value of human life at all. I mean, human life is all right. You have to have a certain amount of it around, and they're willing to tolerate it and try to mold it, but they would just assume that they're really, we're nowhere near as many people as there are, and I think that in many respects, they'd like to see that number actively reduced.
Have you
run into that?
They actually write about that. I mean, for instance, the sustainable development movement that we've been talking about for so long now, if you go back to the report out of the World Commission on Environment and Development, the book called Our Common Future, which is the report, they list a number of goals, and one of the goals is to ensure what they consider a sustainable level of population. That's right on page 55 of the report, and they lay out this plan. And so the whole idea here is, how are we going to do that? Well, you promote things in education like a homosexual lifestyle where, by and large, most homosexuals don't have children of their own. You promote things like promiscuous sex outside of family structures. You promote things like abortion on demand. These are some of the steps you take to help stop what they see as the cancer on the planet, and that is mankind. As a matter of fact, if you honestly believe that man is just a random act, chance, happenstance of natural evolutionary processes, what gives you any more right than the bug crawling up your wall to survive? We just happen to be the lucky ones who have evolved this mind now or something. You know, they hold these really bizarre ideas and therefore blame mankind on all the problems in the world.
But they don't think that they are bizarre ideas. I mean, I've talked to some of these people. And
no, I'm
they
saying
have
in our worldview they're bizarre, but them,
our worldview, they're bizarre to their worldview. They're perfectly all right because they have a different worldview. And I think really until our average listener can understand that there are people who look at the world entirely different. They put no value on human life. They'd just as soon remove a lot of the human life that's out there. They are actively encouraging homosexuality, not because they themselves are homosexuals, but because homosexuals don't reproduce. And wouldn't that be wonderful? Then there wouldn't be so many people in the world. And actually, we have things put out. If any of you'd like to see the page from Family Planning Perspective back in 1970, talking about population control and how to come about doing it and suggesting homosexuality. We'll encourage homosexuality. Why would anybody do that? Because they think they're doing good. Because they really want to destroy humanity. Well, I guess it's Michael Chapman, and certainly we're talking about the people with the other worldview, but unfortunately, many of these people are working within our educational system, and many of these people control our educational system and are using our tax money to change our children's worldview as well, and to distort their sense of right and wrong and reality, and as we saw here in the Monterey Bay area, just as last few days, had them out demonstrating, you know, for against immigration legislation. They've got all these kids to do exactly what they want to. They're using our school to program the minds of our children, and not just on immigration issues, but on every aspect. They control what our children think, and fortunately, 20 years from now, they may be able to think independently, but right now, so many of our young people are simply coming to accept the lies that they're being taught in school. School should teach you to think, should teach you to question, but these children don't question. They simply obey exactly as they've been conditioned to by their educational system. I think that is a criminal act. I think to destroy the mind and the ability to reason of our children, to take away their innocence, to take away their modesty, to focus them on death education and sex education and suicide education and depravity education. We got real problems in our schools, don't we, Michael?
You bet we do. And that's a perfect analysis. Really, public education is no longer about education for knowledge. It's now about shaping values, attitudes, and beliefs. And rather than testing our children for objective knowledge, we now assess them to determine their value to this new future society based on how well they now demonstrate this new way of thinking. That's the reason you no longer hear us talking about testing. We now talk about assessments. We assess our homes for its value. We now assess our children for their value to this future new society. And one of the most important things that this new education system has done is strip us of the true knowledge of our own history. And one of the reasons for that is because the Declaration of Independence itself stands in the way of transforming society into this new humanistic global society that they're pushing for. Just think about it. A Declaration of Independence, we've now replaced that with a Declaration of World Citizenship. Interdependence rather than independence. The Declaration actually is our foundation document. The Constitution was only written in order to form a more perfect union. It is the working papers that put in place the Declaration of Independence. And one of the reasons we at EdWatch up in Minnesota have been pushing so hard to try to get the Declaration principles put back in education. Those principles include the things like natural law, self-evident truth, the idea that all people are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights, that government's purpose is only to secure those God-given rights, and that government is only given the permission to have that power based on the consent of the citizens. These are radical ideas to this new agenda.
And because our children are never allowed to hear this, never allowed to understand
this
wonderful message of freedom that was bequeathed to us from previous generations, and they're stripping them of an understanding of what America is about.
That's right. And now we're being swept with new programs called, for instance, the International Baccalaureate is now replacing AP. We've got the Global Classroom.
Hold that. We'll be right back.
Oh, sure.
Bring other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Michael Chapman from MedWatch. And go ahead, Michael. Michael was just basically saying how important, these concepts laid out in our Declaration of Independence are. And, of course, the group he's working with in Minnesota is trying to get these ideas put back into the classroom. They have taken it out. They don't teach our children the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence, this idea that our rights come from God and that governments are constituted to preserve our God-given rights. Why, they can't even mention God in schools today, and really the very foundations of our freedom are never taught. Our children are being programmed to accept a socialist, authoritarian world government rather than be proud to be Americans and to understand the very essence of America. That's really what's so sad, is that they've deprived our children of the opportunity to realize how wonderful it was to have been an American.
Yeah, and what gave us our success were those principles put in action, and those principles that were put in action through the Constitution. But you see, without the Declaration principles, the Constitution can virtually be made to say whatever it wants to say, whatever liberal judges make it say. And one of the most important aspects of this whole new transformational education are the national standards for civics and government. In fact, even No Child Left Behind continues a funding mechanism to the tune of over $400 million now. A non-government organization called the Center for Civic Education out of California, UCLA, they started in Berkeley and they're now at UCLA. But this organization, if you go to their website, cived.org, you can look for an article called The 21st Century Mission of Schools. And just to give you an idea, since we fund them, they hold the government contract to write our national standards and assessments in civics and government. They also publish the model curriculum textbook. And there was no vote for these people. They were just appointed to do this and funded by our government. At this article, The 21st Century Mission of Schools, they say, and I'm quoting, "In the past century, the civic mission of schools was education for democracy in a sovereign state. In this century, by contrast, education will become everywhere more global and international. And we ought to improve our curricular frameworks and standards for a world transformed by globally accepted and internationally transcendent principles." Now, these are the words of the people directing the standards, assessment, and curriculum for every school in America.
And I think what's so important is to understand there really are people in key positions who hate America and hate everything it stands for. They have this globalist view. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have a world government, if everybody could have a higher standard of living, if, you know, we never would have wars again. And they are using our educational program and our tax money and our schools to indoctrinate. They're not teaching our children. They're indoctrinating them in these globalist views. And this is a criminal effort. It is a conscious, treasonous effort to change America. When we elect our officials, they swear to uphold our Constitution. And many of them have no intention of doing that. Their purpose is to destroy our Constitution, to change the meaning of the Constitution, to talk about a living Constitution, to talk about our democracy, knowing full well America was never a democracy. It was established as a republic so we would not fall into the trap that previous civilizations had, where democracy has always ended up in despotism, because these people really believe that we need a ruling elite to determine the course of civilization, because we common people are just incapable of knowing what's best for us, and they know so much better than we do.
Yeah, just to show you how much we've lost of our history. Now, I know a lot of people know this, that we're not a democracy, we are a constitutional republic. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution lays that out. But, you know, you will never find the term democracy in any of the 50 state constitutions, in the federal constitution, in the Articles of Confederation, in the Declaration of Independence, in any of our founding documents for a reason. And that reason is because our founding fathers understood that the most famous popular vote in all of history was crucify Christ. And that is the definition of pure democracy. In fact, the father of our Constitution warned us by saying pure democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention and have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property and have been as short in their lives that they have been violent in their deaths. Now, why aren't we teaching those words to our children?
Well, that comes from the 10th of the Federalist Papers. You know, it's amazing. If you go, and even if you're in the college, when they teach you the Federalist Papers, they always delete that one. The last thing they want is for the American people to understand that we are not a democracy, we're a republic, and there's a very definite difference between a republic and a democracy. In fact, we have a little pamphlet going into that. One of the most important things you'll learn tonight, you'll learn in school, but unfortunately, you don't learn that in school today. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Michael Chapman, and we're talking about, well, we're talking about what's happening to our schools, to our children, the program that has been introduced, a planned program. It's not accidental. The people who are altering the history of America, who are altering our textbooks, who are planning to indoctrinate all children in America. That's why they need a federal curriculum. It's much harder to control 50 states than one centralized authority. And in fact, the founding fathers feared that the day would come when all power would be in Washington, D.C., and we would have a government as venal and oppressive as the one that we'd just recently been separated from, referring to King George III, and now we seem to have King George II in Washington, D.C. Would you pick up the story?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good point. You know, I really honestly believe in my travels around the country and in Washington, I am convinced that our elected representatives really haven't got a clue what form of government we are or where the ideas came from or why we have those ideas. I honestly don't believe they've been teaching civics and government accurately for the past two generations at least. And so that means our future leaders that come right from our own ranks and right out of the public school system don't know where the ideas came from. A lot of people ask me, well, you know, if our founding fathers were so religious and so Christian, why didn't they mention the Bible in the Constitution? Well, the fact is they do, but more importantly, they don't have to. It's where the ideas that are in the Constitution came from. For instance, the three branches of the government came from Isaiah 33:22. God is our king, lawgiver, and judge. Those are the three branches. Article 1, Section 8, the Uniform Immigration Laws, came right out of Leviticus 19:34. Article 2, Section 1, where the president must be a natural-born citizen. Sorry, Arnold, but that's the law. It came from Deuteronomy 17:15. Article 3, Section 3, on and on it goes. It came from Deuteronomy 7:16 and Ezekiel 18:20. These are where the ideas came from that formed our Constitution. The only place you can't nail down to a biblical source in our Constitution was the original compromise that left slavery legal, because the Bible is very clear that slavery is an abomination to God. So you see, the ideas that formed us are really Christian in their root. You don't have to mention the source of the ideas to be a Christian document. It's just where they happen to get the ideas from.
But don't you think, of course, that the Constitution was really, of course, preceded by the Declaration, and that was really the Articles of Incorporation. Everybody knew that at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Michael Chapman, and Michael was just talking about the fact that in our Constitution, all of the ideas that were laid out, whether it be the three divisions of government or the president would have to be born in our country, or so many of the ideas that we associate with the Constitution, they all came from the Bible. And then, of course, I pointed out that you didn't have to talk about the Bible in the Constitution, although they talked about how it was signed on the day of our Lord, and certainly the president would have a certain number of days to either sign or veto a law. But, of course, leaving out Sunday, why leave Sunday? Because everybody knew that was God's day. At least it used to be God's day. Now we're going to have Sunday night football, you know, a real affront to the God of the Bible. But be that as it may, everyone knew when our Constitution was established that the Articles of Incorporation was the Declaration of Independence, which talked about God and the fact that our freedom came from God. So how can you preserve a country when the Supreme Court has taken any mention of God or the fact that our freedom came from God in the Declaration of Independence? Our Supreme Court has taken that out of our schools. They won't even allow the Declaration of Independence to be posted on the walls of our schools. Many of our textbooks, like Houghton Mifflin's textbooks, when they talk about the Declaration, they say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were ... and endowed with certain inalienable rights. All mention of the Creator is removed from our textbooks that we pay for. Why? Because I believe there's a conspiracy against God, but pick that up, Michael.
Well, Again, as I read at the very beginning of the show from the National Curriculum Standards for Social Studies, the goal is to transform America, not to preserve it, not to pass on the keys of freedom that our founders gave us to future generations, but to change the ideas the people hold. So they can't see the 12 principles of freedom in the Declaration of Independence because those principles stand in the way of the transformation. One of the myths, of course, is separation of church and state. A lot of people don't realize that that phrase is nowhere found anywhere in our Constitution. It's actually, you can go to the Soviet Union's 1936 or 1977 Constitution and find it, but you certainly can't find it in ours. In fact, I'm a rare book collector, and I collect textbooks from our founding era on forward and Supreme Court cases and different founding documents. And one of my favorites is Daniel Webster's defense in 1844 of the Christian religion in public schools, now or in any schools. And what he was actually doing was this was a case brought up against a private school that wished to teach civics without the Bible. And that went to the Supreme Court and was successfully defeated because Daniel Webster, and I'm quoting right from his original, which I hold in my hand, he said, "I have shown that the Christian religion, its general principles, must ever be regarded among us as the foundation of civil society." In fact, if you go to most state constitutions still, but at one time all of them, in the preamble, gave God thanks for both our civil and religious liberty. For instance, the Minnesota Constitution says, "We the people of the state of Minnesota, being grateful to God for our civil and religious liberty, do ordain and establish this Constitution." You see, the real idea of separation of church and state, if you want to use that term, was that there are two institutions here. There is the church and there is the state. Both have their clear and present duties. The church isn't supposed to maintain a standing army, and the state isn't supposed to take on the function of the church or the caring of the poor or the education of our young. That was always the function of the family and the church. So we were grateful to God for both our civil and our religious liberty, saying that God is the source of all authority, regardless of the institution. But he himself put in the Bible clear divisions of what those institutions were supposed to be about. And that's what our founding fathers cited. We are one nation under God because both our church and our state institutions derive their authority from that one source. This is the true meaning of separation of church and state. We didn't want a church-controlled state, and we didn't want a state-controlled church, but neither institution was supposed to divorce itself from biblical principle.
Well, I think our federal government has totally divorced itself from biblical principles, and that's why we're moving into a state of chaos and crisis today.
Absolutely. And even among the least religious of our founding fathers, I mean, it was Benjamin Franklin who called for every session of Congress to open with prayer, saying, "If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, except they build, the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it." Wonderful words from Benjamin Franklin. And of course, Jefferson, in reference to slavery, said, "God, who gave us life, gave us liberty, and can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we've removed the only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I realize that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever." This from the two least religious of our founding fathers. And I believe if Jefferson was alive today, he would have opened that by saying, "God, who gave us liberty, gave us life." Because, you see, he understood that both life and liberty were gifts of God who created us to have life and liberty. And so we are violating his decree through slavery in Jefferson's day and through abortion in our day. It's no different than what we faced early on in our country's history.
Well, I share your concern, Michael, and I just think it's such a tragedy that our young people are being deprived of an understanding of the wonderful heritage that they have been, that we had inherited, but unfortunately we're not doing a very good job of passing it on to them. Well, tell us a little bit about how things are going up in Minnesota. My understanding is that you've really been able to have some impact and been able to reintroduce some of these ideas into the curriculum up there. Is that right?
Yeah, well, we've opened some doors. I mean, we're constantly fighting, and we're trying to replicate this around around the country. After a six-year battle, last summer, we finally had signed into law what we've called the American Heritage Act. And basically, it's amazing because these things will pass if they see the light of day, if you word them correctly. Basically, what we said in this bill was that districts may not censor instruction in American and Minnesota state history or heritage based on religious references in the original source documents, writings, speeches, proclamations, or records. I mean, can you imagine giving that bill to a liberal? Gee, you know, I don't want religion in there, but I'm certainly not in favor of censorship. I mean, they're the ones always calling us the censors. Folks, the only book censored from the multicultural table is the Bible and anything Western civilization based on it. So all we have to do is write the bills right. And so what we did was we wrote this bill that in such a way that a vote against it would be a vote in favor of censorship. And that for that reason, we couldn't get it out of the democratically controlled Senate Education Committee until we got a little foot in the door and did some wrangling, and they refused to put that paragraph in the bill, but they put just one line of it in. And in the House version, the whole thing passed. Well, it had to go to conference committee and compromise, so we made it a media show, and we got the thing out of committee by one vote. And once it was out of committee and it went to the full Senate for a vote, it passed unanimously.
And of course, everybody would be almost afraid to vote, you know, publicly, because
right.
They don't want the people to realize that there's some people who hate America.
That's right. And I want to alert your listeners, go to my website and you can get the full text of the full House version and what finally passed on my website at AmericanHeritageResearch.com.
That's AmericanHeritageResearch.com, and I recommend Michael's material to you. It's straightforward, and I mean, he's coming from the right point of view. That's AmericanHeritageResearch.com. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then I also put together a video called America's Censored Heritage, where I actually show on the video actual pages out of our curriculum where they've censored our history, and then from our founding documents that shows what they had censored out. And so it's basically material that you can pull from to use as testimony and to replicate this in your own states. Now, I had a little help with David Barton from Texas. He came up and testified, and we've prepared, we're hoping to put together a video that has his testimony on it. I still need to talk to him about that. But in the meantime, get this America's Censored Heritage. I'm not trying to sell products. I'm just trying to equip you with information that is powerful and useful for you to fight these battles in your state. We can win this battle as long as we still have the freedom to participate in our governance structure, our government. We can go in and find sponsors of like-minded people who can be educated on to carry these bills for us and give them the backing they need to pass these things. Now, what this bill actually did was it didn't really solve the problem. What it does is it opens the door and allows teachers who know this material and know about it to bring our true history into the classroom free from fear of ACLU lawsuit. Because before this bill, we were having lawsuits all the time, the threat of the so-called separation of church and state violation that would scare districts and scare teachers from bringing this material into the classroom. Well, with this bill, that gives them the backing they need to know they can go into the classroom with this and, hey, look, this is not a religious lesson. This is simply history. If you want me to take out the writings of George Washington, the writings of Thomas Jefferson, the writings of Benjamin Franklin, if you want me to leave these out of the classroom, you're asking me to censor our history.
Well, let's go to Ron, who's calling us from Richardson, Washington. I think it's a great way to approach things. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Yes, Dr. Stan. I really enjoy your guest.
Well, he's a very articulate individual. I always enjoy having Michael on. Go ahead.
Well, we had a fellow in Washington State, Monty Benham. I think you've had him on the show before.
Right.
And he had tried to get an initiative passed that required the teaching of the Declaration and the Constitution in our schools. And he got kind of ridiculed by the media, of course, and they never did get enough signatures. I don't know if he's going to try again someday.
But of course, he needs, first of all, we have to educate the people. And that is why, you know, it's so important that we do have at least, you know, some stations up there in the state of Washington that will get the truth out to the American people. I think it's so vitally important that one state at a time we begin to educate the people to understand our heritage of freedom and the fact that there are people who want to take that away.
Well, we had a they opened the sessions with prayer at the state legislature, and they had a Muslim imam open the session one time.
Right.
Yeah, you see this you're hitting the battle right where it, right at the front line. Both the Declaration principles and prayer in the legislatures. We've done the same thing here in Minnesota. We had a bunch of monks come in and chant for an opening prayer. This would absolutely violate everything our founders stood for. But this is part of the myth that we are a pluralistic nation. You see, pluralism suggests that all ideas are equal. The model, E Pluribus Unum, says out of many people from various different backgrounds, all met together under one idea of freedom, and that idea is inherently Christian. And so what they've done is they've turned that formula on its head. Now we have to talk about multicultural diversity and pluralism, but that has nothing to do, really, with your cultural background. It has everything to do with saying that all ideas are equal, and therefore all are equal at the table. And so what the legislatures on the left are trying to do is force the issue, and unfortunately those on the right haven't got a clue how to defend against it. And so what your friend did in Washington by going after the Declaration principles was go right after the heart and soul of what can break through this. And you just have to do it right. Keep in mind that Eric Martel of the Fordham Foundation actually called it, in testimony in Minnesota against My American Heritage Act, called it, this is a quote, he called it a historical error to consider the Declaration a founding document that sets forth guiding principles for our nation.
Well, those guys are pathological liars.
Yeah.
And they will lie, do anything they have to advance their agenda.
Well,
that's the removal of all ethical constraints from their behavior.
That's absolutely right. But see, keep in mind, they're scared to death of this issue because they know it's an issue that they can only win through censorship. Because once the truth is out there, and once our teachers are teaching these principles as the founding principles of our nation, they lose the game. That's why I think this is so powerful and important to get into all these states. The various forms of this have passed in about a dozen states. David Barton's been working on a lot of this kind of thing as well. And I think it's sweeping the nation, and it's got them scared. I still think we can win this. But it's going to be a long road, and we've got to be vigilant, and we can't give up, and we can't be discouraged.
And I think, Ron, the thing is that the vast majority of American people love this country. And, you know, even they did a poll after they got forced Judge Roy Moore off the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama, and well over 70% of the people who were polled, and this was reported in the Humanist magazine, over 70% of the people polled thought that the courts were wrong and Judge Roy Moore was right to want to display the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, and these people didn't know that we've got to do something. These crazy people don't want to go along with our agenda. And that's it. You see, these people are subversives. They really want to destroy this nation. They know that they do not have the support of the American people. They don't care about it. They hold the reins of power, and they've targeted the next generation. They've targeted our children. And, Ron, let me suggest that you go to get on the email list I think it's that Alan Quist puts out emails on a regular basis. Do you put out regular emails as well?
Yeah, that's EdWatch.
EdWatch.
That's our more active, American Heritage Research is my website, but I'm on the board of EdWatch, and with Alan Quist, Dr. Karen Ephraim, who's doing wonderful work to stop the mental health screening of 3-year-olds, and we just tabled that yesterday. in a Senate session. That's sweeping the nation right now. They're trying to get the cradle end of the cradle-to-grave system right now. Mm-hmm. Oklahoma is facing it. Illinois already passed it. That's sweeping the nation. But if you go to edwatch.org and sign up for our email alerts, we'll let you know what's going on now. We can take the offensive because we're no longer operating from a defensive position. We know what's coming, we're watching for it, and we're alerting people all around the country to exactly what the next step is.
And so let me suggest you go to EdWatch and get their information. Ron, thanks very much for calling.
Thank you, sir.
God bless. Bye-bye. And, of course, I think it's so important that people all across the country get involved in this battle because it's really a battle for the hearts and the minds and souls of our children. And there are people who'd really rape the souls of our children and fix their attention on sex and fix their attention on pornography and fix their attention on immorality and on death and on suicide and all sorts of things which have a profound and terrible effect on them. They're stealing their childhood. They're stealing their heritage and our heritage, and it's time we begin working to take America back. Well, Ron, we've got about 3 minutes for you. Pardon me, Michael, we've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program tonight.
Well, I would just say that there's probably one more warning out there I didn't get out in this hour that's really key, and that is what they're pushing is rather than the Declaration of Independence, they're pushing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you've got to remind people to read Article 29 of that document because it sounds like a wonderful document up until... You know, of course, it does enumerate rather than limit government. It enumerates a right. Article 29 actually tells you where the rights come from. It says, these rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Now, that puts government as God, in the replacement of God, and that's what we're facing. And I would just end with a quote from George Washington, who warned us in his circular to the states in 1783. He said, whatever measures contribute to violate or lessen the sovereign authority ought to be considered as hostile to the liberty and independence of America, and the authors of them treated accordingly. You said it right. The Center for Civic Education, these curriculum standards for social studies, the agenda of the left in education is treason. Nothing less than treason. And they should be treated accordingly.
And I think until the American people understand that there are people working within the leadership of both major political parties at both the national and the state level who hate America, who want to transform America, who talk about our Constitution, but they don't believe in it because they have a different worldview. Until people understand that, nothing makes sense. And behind everything we've talked about tonight are these powerful spiritual forces which are moving America away from our heritage of freedom towards a globalist society. I would not say it's a godless world, but it will certainly be a different type of God, a different type of religion. Well, Michael, I really want to thank you so very much for being with us. I think that you're certainly one of my favorite, most articulate guests we have, and it's always a pleasure to have you with us. I hope we can get you on to some of our other programs in the not-too-distant future.
Well, Stan, I'd be honored anytime. You've done so much good to get the word out there, and it's really an honor to speak with you.
Anytime you have something and need to get out, you know how to get in touch with me. And of course, that's true for Karen Ephron, Dr. Karen Ephron, and Michelle Bachman, and certainly Alan and Julie Quest, who are doing a great job right along with you. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, and God bless.
Good night. God bless. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you've enjoyed our conversation with Michael Chapman, who comes from the board of EdWatch up there in Minnesota. A small group of people really can make a difference. And you can too, but you've got to be organized, and you've got to organize now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and first, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Michael Chapman. As I was saying, if you want to get in touch with that group, Mr. EdWatch, or EdWatch, just plain old EdWatch now. It used to be Mr. Edco, but now it's edwatch.org. org or edwatch.com. Get in touch with them, get their emails, get their information, and get it out in your community. And, of course, the other thing is help us reach people all across America with the truth about what's going on. Now, let me mention that probably the best way to understand what is really taking place is my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't read it, shame on you. You need to get it, and you need to get it in other people's hands. Now, ordinarily, if you'd like to get the book, you can get it directly through my ministry by calling 1-800-544-8927. And the story is there. It's on the DVD. We have it on video. We have it on audio tape. You can get all of them together in the Brotherhood of Darkness special. But at the present time, we're offering cases of the book at a very, very reasonable sum. And, of course, this is because we're going to do a mass printing. And if you would like to actually get a case of the books, give us, and like more information, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at the situation. I think that if you have the books, why, you can dispose of them in any way you want to. I know some people are selling the books, other people are giving them away, but we need to get the book into the hands of as many people as possible, because it goes into the fact that there is a spiritual battle going on in our society today, and there truly is a conspiracy against the God of the Bible. After all, you can read about that in the scriptures. They tell you about the conspiracy against God, but you can see it in effect today. As our political leaders tell us, we all worship the same God, Allah, you know, the God of the Jews, the God of the Christians. No. The God of the Muslims is not the God of the Jews and the Christians. The Christians are waiting for the Messiah. The Jews are waiting for the Messiah. The Christians are waiting for the Messiah to come again. But we worship, in effect, the same God, but not the God, not the moon God of the Muslim religion. So there are, though, people who would try to convince you that it really doesn't matter what God you worship as long as you worship God, and that's not true at all. There is one true religion, and unfortunately, there is an effort to destroy that true religion. There is a spiritual battle being played out here in America and throughout the world today. And it's a battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And the tragedy is most people don't even know there's a battle going on. So we hope that many of you will go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, pull down our newsletters. If you'd like to get a free newsletter, if you'd like to really understand what the war on terrorism is really about and why it is we're having to give up our freedom here in America because of the threat of Islamic terrorism, why we are going to war with Iran in the not-too-distant future, and what is going to happen to America as a result of that, why, you would be glad to send you a free copy of our latest newsletter. That's the February newsletter. Why our leaders are so intent upon going to war with Iran. Why we invaded Afghanistan and then forgot about Osama bin Laden and invaded Iran. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, and then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you, of course, to hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about, what's really going on in the world today. And it's so good to have Joel back here at Radio Liberty after being away for, was it almost a year, Joel?
That's correct.
All right, well, it's good to have you back with us, and we'll just be going through the various items in the issue of World Affairs Brief that has just come out. So with that, without further ado, Joel, you pick up the story.
Well, one of the big stories this past week was the large-scale, extraordinary large-scale protest against immigration reform. And, immigration reform is not something new. Conservatives have been attempting to get the Bush administration to enforce the law and to essentially close our borders to illegal immigration, and the Bush administration refuses to. There have been many methods that they have used to do this. For example, the Border Patrol, from higher officials within that organization, keeps shuffling their poor Border Patrolmen to areas where the Mexicans do not cross. They also prohibit them from using any kind of force. There's a catch and release provision if they don't have space to hold them. They really aren't deporting hardly anyone in the Mexican community, and so there really hasn't been any enforcement of the existing law. And yet Congress, at least the House, has attempted to for several years to tighten up enforcement, as well as to build a fence along the border to make sure that this open border situation does not continue.
Now, of course, the thing is that the Bush administration really has an entirely different agenda. They don't want to enforce our laws. They really want to alter the very structure of our society, because they're dedicated to this sort of globalist concept and really uniting the United States and Mexico and Canada into sort of one unit, and that probably eventually incorporating Central America. They really are dedicated to doing away with national sovereignty, aren't they?
That's right. The multicultural agenda is part of that solution on several fronts. First, it's important to water down conservative voting power within the United States. Most Americans, even though they are of immigrant origin from many, many years past, have developed a free market conservative mentality. This has been eroded somewhat, of course, by the more pragmatic view of, as long as the economy's good, nothing else matters. So we've lost a lot of the moral conservative values that used to exist within the country. But nevertheless, our voting power in the United States has been seriously eroded in those states where you have strong minorities of Mexican Americans. Now, those Mexican Americans who have become part of the free market economy have actually become somewhat conservative, but they're a very small percentage relative to the general welfare recipient which comes across the border looking for welfare benefits here in the United States. And there isn't that much welfare in Mexico, actually. There's some subsidized rice and bean prices, but they really don't have much of a welfare system. Frankly, they can't afford it, because such a large percentage of the people are on welfare.
Just hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen as we explore really this very real problem with these mass demonstrations. Go ahead, Joel.
Okay, let me see if... the big question in this week's World Affairs Brief was the suspicion about who's planning and coordinating these immigration protests. There's no way that this could have been spontaneously generated all across the nation. Major protests, the size and coordination of all these organized things defies description. It has to be some general coordination. As it is with any protest, you know, people just don't get out in the street unless someone is activating, telephoning, using the media. And we find, as I've analyzed this for this week's brief, the media was complicit in this. Congress was complicit. The administration was complicit in making sure that activists around the nation got the word that they would be able to go out in force and that the police would not interfere. This is something that leads to a bit of collusion and conspiracy, because most of these cities where these, well, all of these large cities, frankly, where these protests have occurred, have to, people have to secure a permit, and there have to be, be scrutinized, there has to be police supervision of these, because you're actually disrupting traffic. Police were nowhere to be found in any of these protests, and this is very, very questionable, because someone had to give them orders not to enforce the law. That's the main point that I want to make here. This was a blatant defiance of law, and there wasn't one city where state official and federal officials acted to arrest or deport any of these protesters. So I also looked into the aspect of Congress. You know, one of the things that came to my attention, which seemed rather strange, was that on December 21st, when the House of Representatives passed a very, very stiff anti-illegal immigration bill, I was really quite taken aback. The core Republicans, like Representative Tom Tancredo of Colorado, Ron Paul, and others, have been attempting to shut down the wholesale crossing of the border for many years, and they've been stopped by the Republican majorities in Congress, not the Democrats, because the Republicans were falling in lockstep with President Bush. But all of a sudden, all of that opposition disappeared on December 21st, and in fact, many of the Republicans who were in opposition to a stiff immigration bill began to sponsor and voted to pass it. And the administration was nowhere to be seen.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just pointing out that the Republicans are the ones who've been blocking any effort to stop illegal immigration, a massive illegal immigration into this country, until December, when a bill came forward that was going then to begin to limit illegal immigration. And the Bush administration, which had been blocking legislation of this sort for some time, suddenly stood aside and allowed the Republican-dominated Congress to pass law against illegal immigration, which everybody scratched their head and said, why, after supporting illegal immigration, blocking efforts to stop it for so long, why did the Bush administration suddenly change its position, and why did the Republican leadership change its position and pass legislation that was logical, or was it logical? Joel, pick up the story.
Well, you know, there were several provisions of the bill that were very, very strong. First of all, it made it a felony to be an illegal immigrant. That means that you can no longer detain them and deport them. You've got to prosecute them, which is what should be done. You know, when you simply give them a free trip back across the border, there's virtually no incentive not to try again the next day. Plus, it would impose new and higher penalties on employers who hire them. Actually, Stan, penalties have been on the books for many years, clear back since the 1980s, but they've never been enforced by any administration, Democrat or Republican. In addition, this bill finally called for a 700-mile fence along one-third of the border's total length. Now, this was a very interesting provision, because I'm all for fencing the border. I think if you're going to have a limit on how many people can come into the United States, and you have a border with an unlimited amount of people who want to come across, there's no other way to secure your border than with a fence. But why a partial fence? Here you have a 700-mile fence supposed to cost $2.2 billion, adding to the so-called 80 miles of fencing near Tijuana and a few border towns in Texas. But none of these fences are effective. I had a subscriber call me today to give, after he'd received the brief, and said, let me tell you what about this fence near Tijuana. It actually isn't a fence to keep out people, he says. It's only a fence with cables across it and bars that prohibit any vehicles from driving across the border. But people can walk right through the fence. So it isn't a fence to stop illegal immigration. Now, the fence that was proposed was something that's going to be a double-layer fence with surveillance cameras, and it would actually stop illegal immigration, at least where the fence is. It's like closing up a house with two out of three windows. Well, it doesn't do any good in the wintertime because the wind comes around the path of least resistance, and that's exactly what would happen with a 700-mile fence. People would have a longer trip around to the areas that weren't fenced. So while I'm happy to see someone talking about fencing finally after all these years, a third of a wall is simply an inconvenience. It isn't a barrier. But that told me, Stan, that the proponents weren't really serious about stopping the hordes pouring across the border. What they were serious about doing was to incite a large reaction against this bill. Now, this bill was only passed by the House, by the way. The Senate is much more liberal about this. But this was used as the rallying cry for all of these protest immigrations, the felony provision plus the fencing. They certainly don't want a fence. The Mexican government came out strongly about it. Everybody was crying to beat the band that this was a great, insult to the concept of cooperation between Mexico and the United States.
And that old slogan, why, we're a nation of immigrants, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. What's wrong with immigrants? And it's not immigrants, it's illegal immigrants. And, you know, certainly they were able to build a fence across Great Britain. The Romans built one across 300 or 400 miles. You know, we're talking at, before the birth of Christ. The Indians have built a fence along most of the 2,500-mile border between India and Bangladesh. The Chinese put a great wall to keep out immigrants in China thousands of years ago, but shucks, we can't build a fence between Mexico and the United States. Why, that wouldn't be nice, because after all, we're a nation of immigrants. And they use all of these sophisticated arguments, just to confuse the American people.
Well, and that tells me, when I look at the media coverage on this, the media really is attempting to promote this agenda. It's very interesting that the media is telling where the protests are to occur, where the next one is, and who to get in touch with. They're talking about the websites so that they're pointing to people. They're encouraging the students to drop out of school in California. The administrations of schools are not giving any consequences to these students for skipping classes. They ought to fail them, and that certainly would make them think twice, at least, about getting out of class like that.
But these kids, they have the demonstrations over here in Watsonville. These kids think it's a lark. They have no idea the implications of what they're doing. They have the idea they're just persecuting the poor Mexicans without understanding this is a direct attack on the sovereignty of our country and the financial stability of our nation. And it's an effort, really, to destroy the sovereignty of this country and to give us the same rights they have in Mexico.
You know, what's interesting is the position President Bush took at Cancun today in his summit with Canadian, Mexican presidents. He continually talked about enforcing the rule of law. And this is very, very hypocritical, given the fact that the Bush administration has not been enforcing any of the laws. But he does this in the same sense that he's talking about changing the law to allow for this amnesty, allow for this jobs bill that he's got involved with this. And then he adds to that, then we enforce the law. In other words, we keep watering down, we take away the enforcement provision of the law, and now we're going to enforce the law. But I have to remind President Bush that that's exactly what Clinton pulled on the United States when he pulled that first amnesty in the middle 90s. He said, this is the last one there is. We're going to allow everybody to come in and be able to be citizens, and they gave them green cards, and they allowed this process. And here we are again with the same thing. And, of course, millions have come across the border since Bush started talking about this 4 years ago because they knew we've got to get in under the deadline. One of the interesting things about the congressional Republicans who were opposing Tancredo, who suddenly got religion, got on board this immigration bill on December 21st, they're now allowed to go out to their constituencies who have been demanding that we do something about illegal immigration and say, look, I was a sponsor of this bill, and it passed, and I tried. These people, of course, will be the first one to jump on the Senate bill, which is by Arlen Specter, which is an amnesty bill masquerading as a jobs bill. And, of course, the media, doing all the hand-wringing with their commentaries of pundits warning about the violence if we don't help these illegal immigrants, if we don't give them an escape valve, that is, allow them to become citizens. All this is meant to put pressure on Congress, and we're seeing the Senate bow to this kind of pressure and immediately begin to talk about wanting to do both. I guess it was Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who today was talking about we want to enforce law and we want to be charitable to these, and we want both at the same time. I mean, this is just like Bush talking about the side of his mouth, wanting both rule of law and to be compassionate conservatives to illegal immigration. But as Tom Tancredo so eloquently said, we have that to do this, that is to give them an amnesty, is bad policy, and any bill granting jobs and citizenship to illegals is a slap in the face to every single person who's done it the right way. And indeed it is.
And I certainly agree, and the thing is, of course, they're confusing the American people. They don't usually refer to them as illegal immigrants or illegal aliens. It's just immigrants to America. And by the use of terms and distortions, the media is doing everything to go along with their masters, who really have no loyalty to America, but to this globalist dream. And it's really all about uniting the United States and Mexico and Canada and giving us all the same freedom that they have in Mexico. And the same sort of an economy as well, because this will be a death knell for the sovereignty of our nation.
Well, I predict we're going to see a bill very close to the Arlen Specter provisions passed, specifically in reaction to these major protests, and these protests aren't going to stop. I was sad to see also that French President Jacques Chirac is caving into the protest there about the jobs bill that they passed in France. It was actually a very modest proposal, but a very good proposal in the sense that you know, one of the problems with European job creation is that there are so many regulations and taxes involved with hiring any single employee that it becomes a great disincentive to people to begin employment. If you're already an employer and you're used to doing that and you're paying the administrative and accounting costs involved in employment, it isn't such a factor. But for people just starting up new businesses or people employing people in houses, it's a major factor to have to start to meet the requirements of the law. So the law was changed and passed by Parliament saying, in essence, that a person could hire anyone under 26 years of age and fire them without giving any reason, without meeting any of the regulations, which generally amounted to feather bedding, that they had to prove in court, in essence, this person was totally incompetent in order to fire them. So it was a great disincentive to hire people because it was so difficult to fire them.
And I think it was only really for 2 years, wasn't it?
That's right. It was going to be a trial period for 2 years to see if, in fact, employment had increased, and it certainly would have increased. If they had added, you don't have to pay any taxes, employment taxes on these people, too, you would have had a massive increase in employment. That's the one thing that really keeps thousands of people, including myself, from hiring people, is the fact that you have employment taxes and tremendous regulations, but the taxes are horrendous.
But we're nowhere near as bad as they are in Europe, I don't think.
Well, that's right, but it isn't, we're about a third less in employment regulations and costs, but it's still heavy here. And a lot of people have gone overseas specifically to avoid those regulations.
And that's why many of our jobs are going over to India, or so many of our things are being done at doing our income tax forms in India and our answering services in India. And, you know, you can even get your architectural work done over in India. You get your legal briefs prepared in India. It's a lot cheaper than it is here. And then we wonder why we're losing jobs in America. Well, Joel, go ahead.
Okay, let's move on now to the other side of the world in Iraq. J. Jay Price of the UK Observer rightly observed, and I quote, about 6,000 non-Iraqi security contractors are operating in Iraq. During 9 months in 2004 and 5, contractors fired on 61 civilian vehicles, and no one was ever prosecuted. In just 7 cases were Iraqis clearly attacking, showing guns or shooting at contractors or detonating explosives. All the rest, they fired on vehicles as a preventative measure and then drove away afterwards. And of course, these investigations have been demanded by the Iraqis whose friends and relatives were killed in these attacks. But there's no way really to tell how many civilians were hurt or how many were innocent because in most cases, contractors drove away. No contractor has been prosecuted for any mistaken shooting in Iraq, and that's because I believe there's an unwritten promise of immunity with these insider corporations that are able to get these contracts.
Now, what are these contractors supposedly doing? Are they protecting? Are they, and why are they armed? Are they sort of an independent militia who's answerable to no one?
Well, there are independent militias there that are Iraqi-based, but these are American contractors who are mostly contracted to provide security. But some of them are contracted directly by the Department of Defense, and nobody knows exactly what their mission is. They rove about in these armored SUVs, very powerful vehicles, and they're just roving around patrolling in the city, sometimes drawing fire, sometimes shooting at people. They do house arrests, they do investigations, but, you know, all of this is top secret. It's a matter of national security. If you ever go to the Department of Defense and try to find out what these contracts involve, so it's a real problem. And when you have complaints and someone gets killed, you go to the American soldiers and they say, we don't know anything about it, it wasn't any of our people. And they tell them it was contractors and there's virtually no way to track it down. It's a very serious problem.
How much of the violence that is going on over there is actively being provoked by these contractors? I mean, we find this increasing violence, this violence between the Shia and the Sunni Muslims. We're moving into a civil war, but are these contractors in any way promoting this violence over there, promoting this hatred between the Sunnis and Shias, which has already been there, but you know, when there's more and more violence, why that of course provokes the civil war even more.
Well, there isn't any indication that any of these U.S. civilian contractors were involved in the provocations like the blowing up of the Golden Dome Mosque in Samarra. There were indications that Iraqi government is run by a puppet government, a caretaker government, run by the United States. After 3 months, the Iraqis haven't been able to get their act together and install a separate government. And most of the witnesses involved or that were surrounding the Samarra Mosque had said that Iraqi security people were there, keeping anyone from going into the building after the initial insertion of these special troops who planted explosives there. In other words, the Iraqi Ministry of Interior was protecting the building so that these provocateurs, whoever was planting the explosives, could have free reign within that mosque.
Well, now, were these the Sunnis who planted it? Was it
Shias
or Muslims? Do we have any idea who actually planted the explosives?
Well, the Interior Ministry people are mostly Shiite. And so, but, you know, I'm not saying that these were the regular Shiite people who were attempting to...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about the blowing up of this very, very sacred mosque in Iraq. It was a Shia mosque, and it was really that has provoked so much of the increased violence since that time. And the question is, who really blew it up? And Joel was saying that certainly it would appear that the people who planted the explosives in there were actually were working for the Shia government. Would that be correct, or do we have any idea?
The Ministry of Interior is our best bet at this point, not American contractors, which was the beginning of our subject. American contractors basically are creating hate and discontent simply by killing too many innocent Iraqis and running prisons, doing torture and other things that American troops are very sensitive about not doing now. And I don't think we're finding many American troops involved in this, if any at all, because they know what happens to them and they can be prosecuted. But most of this is reverting to American mercenaries who have this form of immunity. But the American government, which I think has an interest, frankly, in order to justify staying in Iraq, has an interest in making sure that this conflict does not subside. And there are many indications that the private militias that the U.S. has allowed and armed to have free reign are the ones that do most of the provocations. And there are private militias all across the political spectrum, and they're paid for by American tax dollars, as well as some of the oil revenues in Iraq. They're in the southern portion of Iraq. The British have complained about a lot of these militias and the free reign that they have. And there's no way, frankly, that you're going to have any lack of or a diminishing of civil strife within Iraq unless you get a control on these militias.
And these are militias like the Mahdi's army that they refer to. And these people have actually been in direct conflict with our own soldiers. And then suddenly it's like we kiss and made up. And the Mahdi's army that one time we were fighting, now we're embracing, and we're giving them free reign in the southern part of Iraq. That doesn't make sense.
Well, much of what we do doesn't make sense, frankly. I'm fearful of what's going to happen as the United States continues to push for a war with Iran. It certainly, in my opinion, won't be a war like Iraq in the sense of an invasion campaign in an occupation. The United States simply, the American people would certainly never stand for another occupation of a country, especially one the size of Iran, which is much bigger than Iraq and has a much more difficult populace to control. But the Hindu newspaper, which is called actually The Hindu, had a very interesting commentary by Siddharth Vadadajan, who said, in essence, that he predicted that the U.S. would employ a Kosovo-style attack. I quote him, he says, "If Iran were ever to commit this folly," meaning falling into the trap of what the U.S. wants them to say, and they are falling into that trap, "regime change plans will move swiftly into gear. As and when force is used, it would like to be a Yugoslav-style prolonged air war aimed at targeting civilian industrial infrastructure rather than an Iraq-style invasion." And I can see that happening. The U.S. has significant air power assets, and Iran would not have much left after the first week of war after the U.S. targeted their missile batteries, which they do have Russian missile batteries, some Chinese missile batteries, as well as anti-aircraft weapons. But those can be targeted and fairly easily removed. And I would suggest that we would have a major air campaign and then a capitulation by Iran, just as happened with Serbia. This will certainly provoke a great deal of hatred about the United States around the world, because this kind of indiscriminate civilian is what really makes people angry.
But of course, we would inflame the entire Islamic world against the United States should we attack Iran, because they profess to be developing nuclear weapons, but we're then concerned about the nuclear weapons that Pakistan has, that India has, in violation of the laws that China has, that Russia has. We're not concerned about anything but Iran having nuclear weapons.
Well, and we must also mention North Korea. North Korea is in direct violation, kind of a thumb-your-nose attitude toward the United States, and we're not planning any attack, any shock and awe attack into North Korea. North Korea is still working with other countries, shipping missiles and other things, which the U.S. is permitting them to do.
In fact, until recently, we've been the largest source of humanitarian aid for North Korea, the wicked government of North Korea. So many things just don't make sense. I think we may have cut off some of our military, some of our food aid, haven't we, for North Korea?
Yes, that's correct. And we found out a lot of that was going towards the communist cadres to distribute to people only if they were faithful communists. So they were using the political screening mechanism to determine who was worthy of food aid.
And, isn't it amazing? We were financing the communist cadre in North Korea. I guess just another mistake. We'll be right back here in just a moment. All right, Joel, go right ahead.
Well, one of the other things that is most disturbing, a hypocritical position of the the United States is the trial of Zachary Moussaoui. You know, they're calling for the prosecution. The United States marshals are calling for, or attorneys are calling for death, the death penalty for Moussaoui. But there's a great deal of hypocrisy here. If he's for real, and I'm not so sure he isn't anything but an Oswald-type patsy that they set up to be prosecuted, he's really a small-time player compared to the, by the U.S. admission, the masterminds and perpetrators of 9/11, which they have in custody. They have a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who has got a long rap sheet about terrorism in the United States, linked to Project Bojinka, linked to the first World Trade Center bombing, and they've captured him in 2003. They have never put him before the cameras. They keep leaking information, conveniently confirming the official story about 9/11. But no one has seen him. No one has brought him before a judge. No one is prosecuting this man. I mean, if here we have the mastermind of 9/11, and we're just allowing him to sit in some jail, or perhaps it may even be a villa in Pakistan where he is held, this just doesn't make sense relative to the small-time follower Moussaoui, who is all too open, in my opinion, to admit everything that he's doing. His rants in court indicate that he may be under some type of drug therapy or even a little bit of mind control. I noted that this week Yahoo News came out and said that they had interviewed his mother, Aika Al-Wafi, and she said he must be drugged. This is not my Zachary, she said. She would know, obviously, but she says that his characteristic, his outbursts in court are not like him at all.
Well, obviously, there's some very, very strange things going on there, and you know, you almost wonder, you know, here's a man who really isn't capable of flying an airplane. I personally talked to the woman who heads the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma. This man could not fly a single-wing airplane. They actually gave him his money back and told him, you know, that they would not train him to fly an airplane because he was incapable of flying an airplane. And we're somehow supposed to believe he was going to fly a 747 into the White House. Something's wrong with this whole story. Not only that, but certainly 10 or 12 days before the 9/11 attack, the FBI was at the Norman Flight School. They were checking on it. We've never been told that, but that's what the woman in charge told me. So we're not getting the truth. Well, go ahead, Joel. This is an amazing story. Joel is talking about the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. Really be built up, you know, my goodness, we're trying to get Zacharias executed because somehow he is at fault for 9/11. If he'd only told the American people the truth, why they could have held it, they could have, you know, headed off 9/11 and saved all those American lives. And I don't believe that for one minute. I believe they knew everything that was going on. They certainly knew who was going to be on those planes, because they planted their passports, you know, one adjacent to the North Tower, another one in Pennsylvania. Who planted those passports? Why doesn't anybody ever ask the question how those two passports survived the fiery crashes? And nobody ever asked the question. We just, it must be true because, after all, the FBI had the passports.
Well, the entire 9/11 razor-wielding hijackers is a set-up story. For example, none of these hijackers, whoever they were, who took flying lessons, and we do have witnesses to their appearances. It appears, for example, that Mohammed Atta was in Florida working with Huffman Aviation, which turns out to be a CIA front, taking flying lessons. But we really have no proof whatsoever that Mohammed Atta was one of those who was the actual hijacker on the plane. He appears to have been a CIA-trained agent, with a lot of background, and was creating the false red herring leads to paint a picture about hijackers learning to fly on Cessnas. But I know, being a pilot, that none of those hijackers, even if they were successful at flying Cessnas, which none of them were, would have been impossible to fly a large airliner. The systems are so sophisticated, just the switches. The several hundreds of switches that you have take a tremendous amount of training. No amount of flying an airplane an assessment is going to tell you how to operate the physical switchology, let alone the computer displays and the fuel management procedures and the navigation procedures. All of that is very, very difficult to handle if you're not trained in those particular. And the people who flew those airplanes were trained. And that means they weren't the same people who were flying Cessnas. They were trained by major aircraft nations who had those types of aircraft. Could have been Saudi Arabia, could have been any number of the Middle Eastern Middle Eastern countries that are hostile to the United States, or even playing along with the United States if this were a U.S.-induced operation.
Well, of course, would it be possible to actually do this by remote control?
I don't believe so. I have worked with some remote controlling in the early days of those. The reason I say that is that they're very maintenance intensive. There's no way that you would have those on the aircraft without that being common knowledge within the maintenance structure, unless you switched aircraft. But even in remote control, you would have had to have some type of homing mechanism in the building, which is very simple to do. But the second aircraft that plowed into the World Trade Center took a sharp turn at the end. That would not have been done by remote control. In other words, remote control would have drove straight in on a homing device and wouldn't have to make a sharp connection right at the very end. That's typical of pilot air. So I don't feel that remote control was what actually happened. I think the U.S. has suppressed a great deal of the taped conversation on 9/11, but the ones that we do have do hear yelling and screaming, and which is very typical for someone not trained in some of these aircraft. They press the wrong button instead of talking on the intercom to the passengers. The Cleveland Air Center tapes, which have been released, showed them talking about, not only fighting within the cockpit on Flight 93, but the pilot also saying that we have a bomb on board. So there was definitely some type of hijacking going on, and that's not remote control, at least in terms of Flight 93. I don't think remote control could have taken the very hard maneuvers that the Pentagon aircraft took either. So there's many things that do speak out against the remote control scenario.
All right. Well, we really don't know quite what happened that morning. We've been told many things that happened, but, did we really see what we thought we saw? Did the buildings actually come down because of the plane crashes? Did Building 7 come down because of a plane crash, or were there explosives planted at the base?
Well, I think you and I have discussed that many times, and we're both in agreement that these came down by demolition. The proof is very, very strong out there, and we may not have time, don't have time to go over that today. But I'll say that very categorically that there's actual irrefutable evidence that contradicts the stories that those buildings came down with by the crash and the jet fuel of those crashed airplanes.
Well, it's certainly very, very analogous to the Oklahoma City bombing. Certainly, there's no question that there was a truck out in front, but that truck, did explode, but that didn't take down the Murrah building and take out those steel reinforced columns.
That's right. Yes, those were clearly taken out by explosives planted within the buildings, and of course, as you know, Oklahoma television had film crews watching bomb squads disarm several bombs around the perimeter of the building. And those were covered up. And so why would government have any motive to cover those up unless they were covering for agent provocateurs that they themselves were somewhat involved in? And we now know that there was that involvement. And the FBI covered up for those John Doe's 1 and 2 to make sure that they were not brought forth before the grand jury or prosecuted. One of those John Twos, Hussein al-Husseini, showed up at Boston Logan Airport in 9/11 as well. So this looks like, there was government involvement in using agent provocateurs, Middle Eastern people that had been trained. Now, I'm not saying that they knew that they were actually being controlled by the CIA. The CIA or other dark force operators within our government tend to work at the Osama bin Laden level, and then those Middle Eastern terrorist leaders give the orders to the middlemen who think, in fact, they are working against the United States. But the mere fact that the FBI is covering for the identity of those people indicates that the United States government has something to hide about the relationship between the government and those people that might come out if they were arrested and put before a grand jury.
You're speaking now of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Some people, there's a great deal to suggest that he may very well have been a government agent. And certainly that may sound absurd to many of our listeners, unless you analyze what happened with the Irish Republican Army. The number two man in the Irish Republican Army just happened to be a British agent. The chief torturer who was actually torturing and killing people within the Irish Republican Army who were suspected of being British agents was himself a British agent.
And he did that to prove his bona fides.
Right. And here's two of the key people in the wicked Irish Republican Army who were working for the British. How could that happen?
Well, it looks as if, you know, the British were running a provocateur operation as well, because they could have shut down the, you know, with people that highly placed, they could have shut down the entire IRA operation in one fell swoop, and they never did it.
Absolutely, and the same thing might be asked. How much did we really know? How far have we infiltrated this whole al-Qaeda movement right up to Osama bin Laden himself, who miraculously always escapes, or maybe we're not really trying to catch him?
Well, it is my analysis in the World Affairs Brief that, in fact, al-Qaeda is an extension of dark side operation of the United States, and is used specifically for the instigation of terrorist acts in order to justify political changes within governmental systems and to justify a continued, what I call, a phony war on terrorism. And you know, one of the interesting things about it, which I covered in last week's brief about Robert Fisk, where he said, you know, the interesting thing about all the stories about the war on terror is everything they say is government officials said. According to administration officials who refused to be acknowledged, you know, you work through any report about terrorism, and its government officials said there is virtually no independent confirmation of anything outside of what government tells us about al-Qaeda. Even when you look at what the Europeans say or what the Indonesian government say, they get it from U.S. intelligence.
It's almost like a wag-the-dog scenario.
Even the Israelis are getting in on the act. They know that if al-Qaeda is involved, they can get everyone in the world to say, oh, now they've got legitimate terrorism and things. So they've been throwing up the specter of al-Qaeda as well. I just have to laugh when the press throws out this every time someone's arrested. Has suspected links to al-Qaeda. Well, says who? Says the Justice Department. And they've simply invented that out of thin air because no one questions the arresting of a prisoner if he's got suspected links to al-Qaeda.
And, you know, it's amazing how many of the trials have been had here in the United States against these so-called al-Qaeda terrorists or, Islamic terrorist cells. And they've lost about half of those cases. And the others, I suspect, at least some of them have been put away, who are entirely innocent. But they've actually contrived a lot of the evidence on this or withheld, evidence that would have exonerated the people. In fact, they're actually prosecuting a federal prosecutor who had retired based upon the fact that he'd withheld evidence, that to show that these people were actually innocent.
That's right. In fact, the Portland Six were prosecuted and convicted, but it turns out these are old-line communist sympathizers from way back who simply converted to Muslim because this was the latest rage and way to get back at the United States. But this wasn't an indigenous al-Qaeda movement at all. Well, moving on to Afghanistan, Condoleezza Rice and various State Department officials got President Karzai, their puppet government in Afghanistan, to drop charges against this Christian who was being threatened with the death penalty for having converted to Christianity. But sadly, it's my opinion that this had nothing to do with protecting Christians from Muslim persecution, but it had everything to do with the U.S. saving their operation in Afghanistan. It would have been very unpopular with the American people if we had supported with blood and money the liberation of Afghanistan in the name of democracy. And what do they do with that democracy? They start beheading Muslims who have converted to Christianity. That's certainly not something the Americans would look very highly upon and would expect better of George Bush, who himself pretends to be a Christian.
Yes, I agree with you, and I feel I'm just glad that the fellow didn't get beheaded. But after all, we've established, a democratic government there. And this democratic government has accepted Sharia law. And, of course, it's illegal then for anybody who is a Muslim to convert to Christianity. So what we've done is taken the wicked Taliban and replaced them with another wicked government.
Well, interestingly, the court really went out of their way to, this shows how phony the excuses were for dropping the charges. According to the court, the apostate charges were being dropped for lack of evidence. What do you mean lack of evidence? How could that be? He openly admits he's a Christian. How can the charges be dropped for lack of evidence? When that fraud became obvious, the government spokesman changed his tune to the story that Rahman, that's the man who converted, said he held foreign citizenship and therefore outside the jurisdiction of the Afghan courts. Well, that doesn't wash either. You try and use that excuse if you get arrested in Afghanistan as a foreigner for carrying drugs or cocaine and see if it's outside their jurisdiction holds up in court. Not at all. Any of these countries have the right to violate or prosecute anyone, a foreigner included, who violates their law. Just as any foreigner is not outside the jurisdiction of law when they violate U.S. law inside our borders. So that shows you the degree at which they had to grab at straws in order to justify letting this person go, when in fact it was simply a political mandate from the Karzai regime upon orders from the United States, because they simply could not afford to have their Afghanistan operation get a black name. So it's all about saving the continued Afghanistan intervention from embarrassment.
The Afghan puppet government that we've installed there. And, because, the thing is that we talk about democracy, but we really aren't interested in democracy. Certainly in Iraq, right, we don't like the governments that there because they want to go along. They want to have a sectarian government. And so we've just doing everything we can to undermine the democratically elected government.
That's right. The more information, switching topics here, have come up back to the legal realm of the president and vice president. President Bush continues to flaunt the law with these signing statements. I don't know if you've covered that in previous interviews, Dr. Stanley.
No, go right ahead, though. I think it's so important that he signs the laws and then says, I will not abide by the law I've signed.
It's even worse because, you see, the people who protest the Bush position and put up a law, and they work out a compromise with the president about that law. For example, the torture law, that he wasn't going to torture anymore. And then he specifically, after signing the bill and lauding this great compromise, signs a signing statement saying that he's not going to abide by that specific compromise provision of the law. I mean, talk about adding insult to injury. And the same thing happened when Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe has been the main investigator who's been bringing up these concerns about the president's signing statements, said the following. When President Bush signed the reauthorization of the U.S. Patriot Act this month, he included an addendum saying that he did not feel obliged to obey requirements that he informed Congress about how the FBI was using the Act's expanded police powers. Now remember, this was the compromise proposal, that if the police were going to have expanded powers in the FBI under the Patriot Act, the big compromise that got supposedly all of the Republicans on board, despite their constituents not wanting the Patriot Act reauthorized, was specifically this, that you have to have oversight by Congress, and Congress has to be informed about the FBI's use of this. The president comes around and says, I'm not going to do it.
In other words, they're going to sign the law, but I'm going to put a stipulation on that I will not be bound by the law. And, of course, what we really are seeing, Joel, is a Republican Christian administration that is totally lawless, that refuses to abide by the legislation that they've actually signed, has been passed by our elected representatives. What we have is an imperial presidency, and where is the outcry from the Christian leaders in this country? Where is the outcry from the conservative leaders in this country? Why it's muted in its silence.
And it should be a tremendous outcry from the congressman who made the deal with President Bush. In this statement, Bush said he did not consider himself bound to tell Congress how the Patriot Act powers were being used, any more than he feels bound on how to tell Congress about how illegal wiretapping is being used. And what he did say was that this was a violation of his authority to supervise the unitary executive branch of government. Now, this is a code name, unitary executive branch, for do-as-I-please powers to withhold information. This is simply a blatant abuse of the constitutional oath that he took as president.
And not only that, but he has said that if there's a major threat in America, a major emergency of some sort, he wants the right to use American troops in America against American citizens. What sort of madness is this? He doesn't believe in the posse comitatus law. He doesn't believe in the Constitution. And where is the outcry from the Christians of this country? Well, I'm still waiting. We'll be back in just a minute to wrap up this evening's program. Joel, let's get your telephone number. Let's get your website out. How can people get in touch with you and get copies of the World Affairs Brief?
Well, the only way they can get the World Affairs Brief is to subscribe. There's a modest subscription fee. But they can go to my website, World Affairs Brief, and look at past World Affairs Brief to see the kind of analysis I do. And they also get, on the front page there, all of the today's top news stories that my researchers put into the website, and that's all free. There's a lot of free information, a lot of background information on government cover-ups, on how to prepare against these things. So there's a wealth of free information. My news analysis, and this is how I make my living, is by subscription for the World Affairs Brief. And so I would encourage people to subscribe to that and support my work, which supports your work, too.
It certainly does. And, of course, it's the most economical of the newsletters you'll get, and a fascinating analysis of what's really going on behind the scenes. And I get it on a weekly basis. It's one of the few things that I read through from beginning to end, because Joel has an excellent ability to analyze these difficult issues that are so purposely confusing, it's hard to be able to figure out what's really going on, because so much of what's going on just doesn't make sense if you stop and think about it. I mean, you see these things happen, but if you analyze it, you say, why is it, you know, that these things are happening, and why is it we go into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden, and then we forget about getting Osama bin Laden, but we still keep our troops there. I thought we went in there to, we wanted to get rid of the wicked Taliban. And then once we get in there, why we allow them to go ahead and grow all the opium poppies. And America could stop that. Our troops control Afghanistan. So why aren't we trying to stop the drug trafficking? Or maybe the whole war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. Or maybe nothing is as appears to be. Joel, why don't you wrap up the program?
Well, you know, even Vice President Cheney's getting involved in this. He claims now the right to arbitrarily, on his own, declassify documents. And, of course, this isn't true. Only the person who classified something secret has the power to declassify it. And he has to be consulted anyway. And so the president, of course, is trying to defend his chief of staff, Louis Libby, whose main defense now is, I'm not guilty of leaking this to the press because it was authorized by my higher authority. So Cheney is claiming to be that higher authority now and claiming to have the authority, which is totally without justification, despite the executive order that he quotes from.
All right, we're out of time. Joel, thanks very much for being with us. And I'll tell you, it's really good to have you back. Derek and Andrew did a great job while you were away, but it's great to have you back.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith.
Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our Joel Skelton's analysis of what's going on, because we really, we enjoy having him, because I believe he really looks behind the obvious, and you have to understand that nothing is as it appears to be. And when you understand that, everything begins to make sense. If you're looking for logic, I mean, why is it that our leaders are so intent upon going to war with Iran? Certainly, they may be developing nuclear weapons, but China has nuclear weapons. They've already threatened to nuke Los Angeles if we try to interfere with their effort to recapture Taiwan. And yet we're doing everything we can to build up the military capacity of communist China. In fact, the missiles wouldn't work at all if we hadn't transferred the technology to them so that they could MIRV their missiles and get them accurate. And, of course, we're doing everything we can to build up the economy of Russia. We're unilaterally disarming in America. And both Communist China and Communist Russia are in full military production for war. Nothing that's going on makes sense unless there are other forces working behind the scenes. And that, of course, is our message. There are spiritual forces working behind the scenes intent upon destroying Christian civilization. Well, we certainly hope many of you out there will want to get our book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will help you to understand much of what's going on. And, of course, we are still offering cases of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, at a ridiculous sum. And, of course, we do this so we can get our printing done, and hopefully we'll actually be closing the offer, not this week, but the end of next week at the first, the following week. We're 3/4 of the way to our goal. So if you'd like to get a case of the books, why don't you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Brotherhood of Darkness is an excellent means of reaching people and introducing them to the secret societies and the truly dark spiritual forces, the Luciferian forces, which motivate so many of these secret societies intent upon creating a one-world government and a new world religion. And behind everything that's going on is a conspiracy against the God of the Bible. When you understand that, so much makes sense. If you've not yet seen a new DVD we're encouraging people to get, it's called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. We recommend it. My talk on the world revolution. We have a new 4-tape set on the coming financial Armageddon. It's just called The Financial Armageddon. Certainly our pamphlet on the history of money, our talk on the coming financial crisis, all are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope many of you go to our website at www.radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters. You can copy anything on our newsletter, as long as you're not making a profit from it. We encourage you to tell others about our program and encourage them to listen and begin to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. So we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders, and to pray for our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.